The best decision makers are those who are willing to suffer the most over their decisions, but still retain their ability to be decisive. M. Scott Peck goes on to tell this story. For to exercise power is to make decisions, and the process of making decisions with total awareness is often infinitely more painful than making decisions with limited or blunted awareness, which is the way most decisions are made and why they are ultimately proved wrong. Imagine two generals, each having to decide whether or not to commit a division of 10,000 soldiers to battle. To one, the division is but a thing, a unit of personnel, an instrument of strategy, and nothing more. To the other, it is these things, but the general also is aware of each and every one of the 10,000 lives and the lives of the families of the 10,000. For whom is the decision easier? It is easier for the general who has blunted his awareness precisely because he cannot tolerate the pain of a more nearly complete awareness. It may be tempting to say, but a spiritually evolved person would never become a general in the first place. But the same issue is involved in being a corporation president, a physician, a teacher, a parent. Decisions affecting the lives of others must always be made. We are told in 9 little words a decision that Jesus made. He fixed his face firmly to go to Jerusalem. These 9 little words at the beginning of the gospel text can be passed over so quickly we miss their importance. Jesus sets his face toward a direction surely to contain much suffering. He knows what the decision will mean, yet he is able to retain his ability to be decisive. Jesus' journey is both an inner physical journey, inner spiritual journey, and an outer physical journey. His decision to turn toward Jerusalem takes him through the village of Samaritans, a place where he intentionally extends the hand of God, and it is spurned. Jesus' close friends, James and John, want to take action. Shall we order fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Their question is made from blunted awareness, isn't it? They didn't stop long enough to think about what they were asking. All they think of is their leader who has been rejected. The Samaritans hurt our beloved, and we will hurt them. Friends, vindication is not the way of Christ. Striking back because we are hurt is not the answer. To make the decision to follow Christ means we too attempt to be decision makers who are willing to have complete awareness and to explore the ramifications of the decisions we make. If your goal is to avoid pain and to escape suffering, I suggest you find another way to go. I'm not talking about being a martyr, using suffering to manipulate people or situations, which is how I'm using the word here. What I am talking about is being aware that when we make a decision to follow Christ, we are going to know both joy and pain. We might be called to serve God in a way that is painful to us, that is stretching to us or demanding of us. Oh, no, God. You're not calling me to that, are you? If pain might be a part of it, then why would anyone choose to follow this Jesus of Nazareth? I'll tell you what I believe. I believe we follow because there is something deeply spiritual within us that only the radical journey of the love of Jesus, the kind of love that Jesus lives and proclaims, it's that kind that will satisfy that deep need in us. It is not a journey of pain for pain's sake. It is a journey where we are called to give up what we have because what Jesus has to offer, the realm of God, is so much greater. The way of Christ will cause us to know a deeper joy than we've ever known, but it will likely not be without pain. And here's why, in a nutshell. God's way is not the world's way. We see it clearly when followers in this text voice their willingness to walk with Jesus. The first is an eager beaver. He pointedly tells Jesus that he will follow him, and Jesus says, "Oh, but foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." In other words, there may be difficulties on this journey. You need to know what you're getting into. The second wants to go bury his father, and to which Jesus says in so many words, "Don't go back to death. Do not kiss a corpse." In other words, he said, we'll be moving out of the old world of death and into the new and abundant life of God. That's easy for Jesus to say, isn't it? Until you've suddenly lost your loved one and you feel your whole world is crashing in, or you are betrayed so deeply by something or someone that you can't see any possible future. Jesus says, leave all that behind you. Leave it and move into the alternative world that is the grace of God. And finally, the last would-be follower wants to go home and say goodbye to his family. To which Jesus remarks, no one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. Ouch! So direct, so singular. Leave it, just leave it. Follow me and only me, he says. So it seems Jesus wasn't the only one making decisive, informed decisions that day. Each of these followers were retaining their own ability to make decisions, being challenged by what they had to leave in order to do it. The best decision makers are those who are willing to suffer the most over their decisions while still retaining the ability to be decisive. In these followers, we find ourselves, don't we? We want to hold on to the past or hold on to some perceived family obligation. We want to blather forward without thinking about what it means. So often, we pretend we've made a decision when what we've really done is sign up to try until it gets uncomfortable. Jesus is pointedly clear here. It's going to get uncomfortable, but man, oh man, are the benefits worth it. William Willimon, who teaches at Duke Divinity School, recalls, "My sophomore dream trip to Europe, envisioned as a 24-hour-a-day, 3-month bacchanal, got commandeered suddenly one day in Amsterdam. In the Rijksmuseum, while my buddies explored the city, I stood face to face with paintings I'd seen only as slides in Art History 101 at Wofford College. I stood and wondered before a melancholy Rembrandt self-portrait. To my right, an older man intently studied a Van Ruysdael. He looked familiar, but who would I know so far from home? Dr. Marnie. He had a week or so of gray beard, but there he was, Carlyle Marnie. 6 months before, Marnie, as he prefers to be called, had come to Wofford College's annual religious emphasis week and had shaken up many of us with his prophetic sermons. His deep voice had sounded like God if God had been a Baptist from Tennessee. He He swore, even in sermons, and made outrageous comments meant to thrill sophomores like me. Dr. Marty? Who the hell are you? He replied, looking me up and down cautiously. Just a student at Wofford, where you spoke last spring. Marnie stood there assessing me. Why are you here? Me? I'm just bumming around Europe with some guys looking for girls having a good time. You take me for some kind of fool, boy? I've been a preacher long enough to know when somebody is lying to me. Then I guess I don't know why I'm here, I stammered. Good. Maybe we can get somewhere. Unamuno, knowing that you don't know is the beginning of knowledge. Let me help. He grabbed my arm. These Dutch have told me more truth than I can take in one afternoon. God, I need a drink. You? Marnie led me down the steps and into the first bar outside the museum. Got bourbon? He called to the waiter across the dim, smoky bar. Doesn't need to be fine bourbon. This boy doesn't know the difference, and I don't expect good mash this far from home. Two, straight up. Watching Marnie fiddle with his pipe, I was excited, and I felt like I was being taken somewhere dangerous. Now that you've got some liquor in you, he said after his first sip, you ready to talk? No horse crap. Who brought you here? And what's the reason you won't admit? Marnie began tamping sweet-smelling tobacco into his pipe. I thought I was here just to see Europe. My first time and all, I really like art history. You started this, mumbled Marnie, accusingly, settling back in his chair, then closing his eyes, waiting for me to say something of interest. When you were speaking at Wofford, I got to thinking, or else I finally admitted to myself that I was thinking, or had been thinking, or I might ought to think about applying for one of those Rockefeller grants for a trial year at seminary. But, Marnie grinned, as if he'd finally figured me out, son, life's less monologue and more dialogue. It's just I'm really bothered that I'd be thinking about seminary. It seems kind of crazy. Why crazy? Asked Marnie, staring across the bar, feigning disinterest, puffing on his pipe. I began a rambling narration. I grew up without a father, you see. My father left us when... Marnie shook his head. No, your daddy can abscond, die, disown, but everybody's got some daddy or another. I bet you went out and found one, didn't you? Besides, how the devil does not having a daddy explain you here now? God's a God of the living, not of the dead. I was grateful for the table between us. I blurted, you see, since I've been at college, I've read Freud. And I'm thinking maybe my fixation on God is just a compensation for my lack of a father while I was growing up. Wish fulfillment, maybe. Probably, smirked Marnie. My thinking about God is just my psychological reaction to my daddy being in prison and all. Look, said Marnie, laying aside his pipe and moving toward me across the table as if aggravated at having to explain. Son, God will use any handle God can get. Silence. But how can I figure out what's God and what's my own screwed up background? In an exhale of smoke, Marnie pronounced, son, God will take advantage of any messed up background, crooked daddy, manipulative mama. Read the scriptures for God's sake. I swear I've never known a preacher worth a damn who didn't have a bad mama or daddy problem. God can work with either. Be glad you only got one loss for God to work with. Yep, I'm pretty sure God's got your name. Not the first time I've heard this story. You're nobody special. God's fingerprints are all over this. You got time for me to have another one of these? He said, pointing to his empty glass. "My good man," he shouted to the waiter, "this round, don't spoil it with ice. My protege likes it straight. Garçon, encore bourbon." Sometime before dawn, tossing and turning on a dirty mattress in a flea bag monastic cell that three of us had rented for $8 a night, accompanied by the sound of some student puking in the shared toilet down the hall, I said the words that Paul surely prayed when God blinded him: "Why not somebody else? What kind of God would call somebody like me? I do not want to be a Methodist preacher." You can insert anything here: Presbyterian, Lutheran, artist, musician, banker, teacher, candlestick maker. What kind of God would call somebody like you? In my last church, under the tenure of about 10 years, at least three people went to seminary. And it's been a long time since I've made that plea. So if you think God is calling you to seminary, it's not too late. I kid you not. I had a colleague in seminary who was 76 years old, way back in the day. And he received a call after he finished. But there are other things to which God might be calling you. They can range as far as the horizon. The thing is, God's calling for a reason. Calling for something this world needs that only you can give. Something for which God has given you unique and precious gifts. Next time you can't sleep for some flea bag, monastic, cockamamie idea that God has put into your head and heart, see if you can make an informed and decisive decision. And do it. To God be the glory. Amen.